Richard Martin's Wake Up Call Podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin with your Wake Up Call on Friday, December the 18th, 2015, coming to you from Malaysia. Well, today I'm going to present a series of scenarios which we will attempt to use right now to guide our retrospective look at the warning signs which should have been heeded after the crash takes place. Things we can look at today and say we should have seen. And you, my faithful listeners, are all going to be able to say you did see them, but nobody else did. Well, it was the year 1720, and exactly like our world today, Paris had gone completely mad. The city's brand new stock exchange, located at the ultra-swanky Hôtel de Soissons, swarmed with citizens of all stripes looking to get rich. Stocks were still a novel concept back then, and the allure of getting rich overnight was so appealing that people lined up for hours just to buy shares. Yep, just like today's real estate investors camping out in front of the developers' offices to get a slice of the pie. The most popular was the ill-fated Mississippi Company, whose share price frequently rose up to 20% in the course of a single morning. It was said fortunes changed so quickly that people often woke up poor and went to bed rich. Newfound wealth was visible everywhere. Luxury home construction boomed. Lucky speculators erected statues of themselves. The jewelry market surged. Of course, it didn't last. Within a few years, the market crashed, and the Mississippi Company went down in history as one of the greatest bubbles of all times. Looking back, it should have been obvious. In fact, all great financial bubbles often have watershed moments that in many ways signify the height of lunacy. Joseph Kennedy, for example, famously sold all his stocks right before the great crash in 1929 after a shoeshine boy started giving him investment advice. Pets.com, a symbol of the 1990s tech bubble, IPO'd just 2 years after it was founded, with a $300 million market capitalization. They were so flush with capital that they spent $2 million on a tacky Super Bowl ad, only to go bust 268 days later. Duh! It's so obvious looking back. I've long known that our entire financial system was completely currently in a similar position. Western banking systems are dangerously illiquid and in many cases undercapitalized. Meanwhile, the central banks and governments meant to support them are, to all intents and purposes, insolvent and bankrupt themselves. There are countless flashing warning signs right now that the system is quickly running out of steam. China's vast multi-trillion dollar stockpile of foreign reserves is dropping rapidly, down by $87 billion in November, the third highest decline on record. A massive $1.2 trillion worth of corporate bonds in the United States has just been downgraded by rating agencies. Median home prices in over a third of major American cities have once again surpassed all-time highs from the last bubble. U.S. government debt is at an all-time high, after rising an astounding $674 billion just in the month of November. It's pretty clear there's an overwhelming amount of risk in the system. And in the future, when we look back and say, it should have been obvious. Well, here are a few events that may become famous watershed moments. AB InBev just secured an astonishing $75 billion loan to buy rival SAB Miller. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the biggest commercial loan in the history of the world, roughly equivalent to the GDP of Azerbaijan. It's simply unbelievable that anyone should be able to borrow an amount like this, let alone at the low rate of just 1.1% above LIBOR. It's not a stretch to think that we may look back at this and say, that was the top. Such a glaringly obvious example of how much money central bankers have printed. Back in 2013, the yield on high-yield corporate bonds, also known as junk bonds, dipped below 5% for the first time in history. It shouldn't have taken a rocket scientist to figure out how absurd that was. But now that the trend is reversing and the junk bond market is stalling and beginning to crash, investors are losing their shirts. One hedge fund that had invested heavily in junk bonds just suspended redemptions for its investors, something only done in times of crisis. And now there's a second and a third doing exactly the same thing. Well, this could be the historical watershed moment that signals the beginning of the end of our massive financial bubble. Okay, let's try this. The Poppy Loan. Yes, I kid you not. San Francisco Federal Credit Union wants to help its customers buy unaffordable homes in the astonishingly overpriced region of Northern California. So they just rolled out a new loan program called the Proud Ownership Purchase Program for You, or POPI for short. POPI loans allow customers to borrow up to $2 million with absolutely no money down. No, I'm not making this up. Zero down, $2 million at 4% interest. Oh, and you don't have to take out private mortgage insurance, that's PMI, either. If you're not familiar, PMI is something that banks typically require when borrowers don't contribute a sufficient down payment. It insures the bank against loss in case the borrower defaults. So, here the bank is taking 100% of the financial risk, lending against property in an overpriced market that's near its all-time high. And they're doing it, ladies and gentlemen, with your money. This is a story so familiar, it's as if they'd ripped it from the playbook of the 2008 housing bubble. We know what happened next, don't we? We know how that bubble ended. Central banks have printed so many trillions of dollars that there's hardly anything that makes sense in the financial system anymore. This is not a consequence-free environment. When people say, oh, don't worry, it's just junk bonds. Remember they said exactly the same thing about the housing market. It's just subprime. Even Ben Bernanke said the same thing as chairman of the Federal Reserve on 60 Minutes. And I said here, right then and there, at that very self-same time, just after the wake-up call began, that's over 10 years ago, I said, ignore these people. They don't know what they're talking about, and some of them who do know what they're talking about are just trying to cover up the cracks, because they know very well what's going to happen next. And there were few of them, but they existed. And nobody listened to me, and nobody listened to the people who warned you that this was all pie in the sky, finance capitalism, and it had no relationship to your life, except that it was about to bring the system down. Well, I have news for you, ladies and gentlemen. What we see today in 2016 is orders of magnitude than what we had in 2005, 2006, leading to 2008. We are looking at the ultimate collapse of all time, and it's dead ahead. And there is nothing that anybody can do to stop it, prevent it, mitigate it, or anything. And as I said to Donald in a fairly lengthy conversation I was having before I started this show today, I said, you know, Donald, you better go out to your bank and take out any money that you have, any money that you have there, and put it under the mattress. Because the debit card that you're going to use to pay for your dinner tonight, one of these days is not going to work, and you will be joining the ranks of those people that you see in grainy black and white photos lining up behind at the banks trying to get their money out. Except that you'll be doing it from the comfort of a restaurant, and they did it, as often as not, in a cold, windy winter, trying to join other people doing the same thing, as often as not, without success. In other words, ruination was the order of the day. And when people say, oh yes, but the Federal Reserve there is the lender of last resort, remember that the Federal Reserve itself is in hoc to $4.5 trillion. So I assure you, those bozos are not sleeping well at night either. Whatever Janet Yellen may have said to you this week about how the economy was on the right footing and now we want to see inflation moving up and all that kind of nonsense. They're playing, and they're playing with your money, ladies and gentlemen. Well, listen to a quote from the famous Russian author Fyodor Dostoevsky in his novel The Brothers Karamazov. Above all, don't lie to yourself. The man who lies to himself and listens to his own lie comes to a point that he cannot distinguish the truth within him or around him, and so loses all respect for himself and for others. And having no respect, he ceases to love. Well, you know, the lies we tell ourselves are only exceeded by the lies perpetrated by those controlling the levers of our society. We have already lost respect for ourselves and others, transforming from citizens with obligations to consumers with desires. The love of mammon has left the country a hollowed-out, debt-ridden shell of what it once was. When I see the data from surveys about the amount of debt being carried by people in the United States and match it up with the totals reported by the Federal Reserve, I'm honestly flabbergasted that so many people choose to live a lie. By falling for the false materialistic narrative of having it all today, millions of Americans have enslaved themselves in trillions of debt. The totals are breathtaking to behold. Total mortgage debt, $13.6 trillion, of which $9.9 trillion is residential. Total credit card debt, $924 billion. Total auto loan debt, $1 trillion. Total student loan debt, $1.3 trillion. Other consumer debt, $300 billion. With 118 million occupied households in the US, that comes to $145,000 per household. But when you consider only 74 million of the households are owner-occupied, and approximately 26 million of those are free and clear of mortgage debt, that leaves millions of people with in excess of $200,000 in mortgage debt. Keeping up with the Joneses has taken on a new meaning, as buying a 6,000 square foot McMansion with 3% down became the standard operating procedure for a vast swath of image conscious Americans. When you are up to your eyeballs in debt, you don't own anything. You are living a lie. The lie was revealed as housing bubble burst and national home prices plummeted by 30%, resulting in millions of foreclosures, the worst recession since the Great Depression, and homeowners' equity falling to an all-time low of 38%. The Fed-induced second housing bubble has convinced millions to believe the lie again. The Fed easy money, Wall Street buy and rent scheme, and the FHA acting as the new purveyor of 3% down mortgages has artificially boosted homeowners' equity back to 57% just in time for the next housing collapse. Living a lie will result in more pain and suffering for those who didn't learn the lesson last time. At least there is an asset capable of appreciation backed by the mortgage debt. Auto loans are backed by a rapidly depreciating asset, while credit card debt allows Americans to live above their means while living their lie. And student loans are the new subprime debt which will never get repaid? The country has been living a big lie since the day Nixon closed the gold window in 1971, eliminating any vestiges of constraint upon central bankers and politicians. The Fed has continuously debased the currency, and politicians have promised voters freebies while waging never-ending wars of choice, creating a warfare welfare empire of debt totaling $18.7 trillion with unfunded promises of $200 trillion. The masses have been lied to by bankers and their mass media mouthpieces, while willfully buying into the lie of living for today and funding it with debt. An entire society bought into the fallacy that a country could transition from savings and investment to borrowing and consuming, with no adverse consequences. The mass delusion is clearly evident in the comparative consumer debt data from 1971, when the US population was 208 million. Total credit card debt was $8.5 billion, that's $41 per capita. And total auto loan debt in 1971 was $40.5 billion, or $195 per capita. Compare that with 2015, when the US population is 320 million. Total credit card debt was $890 billion. That's $2,781 per capita. And total auto loan debt in 2015 was $1.03 trillion, or $3,219 per capita. The population of the US has grown by 54% since 1971, but the amount of credit card debt per person has grown by 6,782%, and the amount of auto loan debt has grown by 1,650%. At the same time, real median household income has grown by 8%. since 1971. Replacing income with debt in order to give the appearance of wealth is nothing but a lie. It requires an even larger amount of debt to generate an additional dollar of GDP. The exponential increase in debt became unsustainable, and the Wall Street lies resulted in a global conflagration in 2008. The desperate effort by the Fed to reinflate the debt bubble through ZERP and quantitative easing has resulted in pathetic economic growth, while leaving willfully ignorant consumers with a record level of debt. A recent report by NerdWallet revealed the outrageous amount of consumer debt millions of Americans have chosen to take on in order to live the lives they feel they deserve. And Wall Street is only too willing to oblige them with credit as they reap riches from the billions of interest paid each year by the debt slaves living on the plantation we call America. In addition to charging away their lives, Americans lie to themselves about how much debt they really have. It's too painful to deal with reality, so they ignore it. The data in the report is frightening. The amount of credit card debt carried by the average household carrying this type of debt is $15,355. The amount of auto loan debt carried by the average household carrying this type of debt is $26,530. The amount of student loan debt carried by the average household carrying this type of debt is $47,712. The average household is paying more than $6,600 in interest per year, which means that roughly 9% of the average household's income is being spent on interest alone. Credit card debt, one of the most expensive types of debt, costs consumers an average of $2,630 per year in interest, assuming an average APR of 18%. 18% when interest rates are 1.2%. These bankers need to go to jail now. If you have the average amount of credit card debt, which is $15,355, and a 15% interest rate, and only pay the minimum on that debt each month, it will take you more than 31 years to repay your debt, and will cost you more than $16,600 in interest payments alone. Scratch that, $18,600 in interest payments alone. The average amount of credit card debt peaked at $16,912 in 2008, fell by 14% to $14,539 by 2012 as Wall Street banks wrote off billions in bad debt, and has since risen by 6% as consumers have been lured back by the Wall Street propaganda machine. Consumers vastly underestimate or underreport how much debt they have. In fact, as of 2013, actual lender reported credit card debt was 155% greater than borrower reported balances. Americans are embarrassed and ashamed by their levels of consumer debt, but they can't stop. A record number of new cars will be so-called sold this year, with the highest level of auto loan debt in history, the longest loan length in history. Rising percentage of subprime auto loans and an all-time high in percentage of leases. These people are underwater on their auto loan lease the second they drive off the lot. But at least their neighbours and co-workers think they're successful. Appearances are all that seem to matter in our society today. Dying in debt will be commonplace in the coming years. Fully 21% of Americans say they don't think they'll be able to pay off their debts, including their car, credit cards, student loans, and mortgages, in their lifetime, according to a survey of more than 1,000 adults by creditcards.com. America's debt-addicted society is dying of an overdose. The Fed's master plan to revive the economy with massive doses of debt has failed. Main Street America is tapped out. Decades of minimal real wage growth, relentless inflation in the things needed to live, like food and rent and energy and healthcare, and wasting money on Chinese-produced consumer crap has left the majority of American households with little or no savings and no disposable income. This is being reflected in the pitiful economic growth and plunge in retail sales since the end of QE3 in October 2014. The system has become dependent upon exponential debt expansion, and as soon as the spigot is turned off, the economy will crash. Bernanke chose not to abandon the Fed's failed credit expansion policies voluntarily in 2008. The end of QE3 and the upcoming interest rate increase by Yellen has ushered in financial collapse, part two. There is no avoiding a collapse brought on by decades of warped monetary and fiscal policies and irrational behavior by bankers, corporations, and consumers. Even if Yellen reverses course when the economy plunges into a deep recession, catastrophe cannot be avoided. Let me again repeat the slogan that used to be permanently affixed to my webpage on PRN, the famous quote from Ludwig von Mises. There is no means of avoiding the final collapse of a boom brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as the result of voluntarily abandoned further credit expansion, or later as a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved. End of quote. Ladies and gentlemen, your country has gone mad over the last few decades. America had a chance to come to its senses in 2008, wipe away the debt, liquidate the criminal Wall Street banks, prosecute the perpetrators, and reorient its economy and society back to one built upon savings and investment, rather than borrowing and consumption. It was not to be. As Bernanke and the deep state decided that their best interest trumped the interest of the people. The Western world has gone stark, raving mad. I never thought I would see this in my lifetime, although it has been long predicted. But it has arrived, and we see it every day. The madness can only be expunged by a devastating collapse. At this stage, reform through reason or political process is futile and can be compared to having an informed debate in a lunatic asylum. It is simply not possible. Your energy and my advice need to be focused on protecting you during the coming tsunami while preserving whatever can be salvaged during the dark ages. Because what follows the collapse cannot be preordained. No one knows the outcome, but any thinking person knows that this rotten, in fact diabolical system that we all live under has to be destroyed if anything better can ever emerge. Let me finish with another quote this time by Charles Mackay from his book Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, written in 1841. Men, it has been well said, think in herds. It will be seen that they go mad in herds, while they only recover their senses slowly and one by one.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake-Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Well, November was another weak month for the industrial economy, in part reflecting unusually warm temperatures that are driving down utility output. Industrial production came in at the Econoday low forecast, down a very sharp 0.6% in November. This is the biggest drop in 3.5 years and the 8th decline in 10 months. Utility output fell a monthly 4.3% after falling 2.8% in October. Mining, reflecting low commodity prices and contraction in energy extraction, has also been weak, down 1.1% for a third straight decline. Well, at the same time that Greenspan was printing in the US like there was no tomorrow, China's new leader, Deng Xiaoping, discovered that Mao had been wrong about the source of political power. Rather than coming from the barrel of a gun, Mr. Deng discovered that China's Communist Party rule might better be sustained from the end of a printing press. China matched Greenspan's turn to easy money with a 60% devaluation of the renminbi, or RMB, that same year, 1994. Thereafter, there was a massive expansion of centrally controlled credit year in and year out. Soon, the newly launched European Central Bank followed in the footsteps of Chairman Greenspan and Mr. Deng. So did the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, other mercantilist exporters like South Korea and Taiwan, the petrostates and the growing phalanx of raw materials suppliers to China, such as Brazil and Australia. Central bank balance sheets have been on a tear ever since. From a combined footing of approximately $2 trillion in 1994, they have exploded to upward of $21 trillion today. This was not chump change for the bingo parlours. It was a high-powered central bank credit, and it has growth at 12% per year for two decades, nearly without respite. This radical post-1994 departure from traditional rules of sound money and common sense is starkly evident in the humongous figures. They are so large because central banks can grow their balance sheets by purchasing government debt and other securities with fiat credits snatched from thin air. Today, central bank balance sheets have become a telltale sign that financial markets are not on the level. Financial markets have become inherently inflated, distorted, and falsified by two decades of relentless printing press money. The combined balance sheets of the world's central banks soared by $19 trillion during a stretch of time when they would have ordinarily grown by a few trillion at most under traditional 3-5% annual growth rules. Well, central banks are pushing on a string. They can't generate more credit, no matter how hard they try, because most of the world is at what I call peak debt. That's the point where households, companies, governments, and even countries are tapped out. They're stuck with such monumental debt burdens that they can't service any additional debt, no matter what the interest rate is, even zero or below. Case in point, the European Central Bank, or ECB, has pushed deposit rates in Europe to negative 0.3%. Yet private credit to households and business remains flat. That's because they are already swamped with more debt than they can handle in an economic context of virtually no real growth. Likewise, Japan is off the charts with public and private debt equal to 450% of GDP. But despite years of zero interest rates and massive money printing by the Bank of Japan, credit stopped growing long ago. Japan is now in its fifth recession in 7 years. And now the Fed is pinned between that kind of rock and hard place too. It has kept the money market interest rate pinned at zero for 84 months running. It has been truly lunatic. Well, one lesson from military history is that once mobilization for war begins, it takes on a momentum of its own and is uncontrollable. This might be what is occurring, unrecognized, before our eyes. In his September the 28th speech at the State of Affairs in the 70th anniversary of the United Nations, Russian President Vladimir Putin stated that Russia can no longer tolerate the state of affairs in the world. 2 days later, at the invitation of the Syrian government, Russia began war against ISIS. Russia was quickly successful in destroying ISIS arms depots and helping the Syrian army to roll back ISIS gains. Russia also destroyed thousands of oil tankers, the contents of which were financing ISIS by transporting stolen Syrian oil to Turkey, where it is sold to the family of the current gangster who rules Turkey. Washington was caught off guard by Russia's decisiveness. Fearful that the quick success of such decisive action by Russians would discourage Washington's NATO vassals from continuing to support Washington's war against Assad and Washington's use of its puppet government in Kiev to pressure Russia, Washington arranged for Turkey to shoot down a Russian fighter bomber, despite the agreement between Russia and NATO that there would be no air-to-air encounters in Russia's area of operation in Syria. Although denying all responsibility, Washington used Russia's low-key response to the attack, for which Turkey did not apologize, to reassure Europe that Russia is a paper tiger. The Western prostitutes dutifully trumpeted, "Russia, a paper tiger!" The Russian government's low-key response to the provocation was used by Washington to reassure Europe that there is no risk in continuing to pressure Russia in the Middle East, Ukraine, Georgia, Montenegro, and elsewhere. Washington's attack on Assad's military is being used to reinforce the belief that is being inculcated in European governments that Russia's responsible behavior to avoid war is a sign of fear and weakness. It is unclear to what extent the Russian and Chinese governments understand that their independent policies, reaffirmed by the Russian and Chinese presidents on September the 28th, are regarded by Washington as existential threats to U.S. hegemony. The basis of U.S. foreign policy is the commitment to prevent the rise of powers capable of constraining Washington's unilateral action. The ability of Russia and China to do this makes them both a target. Washington is not opposed to terrorism. Washington has been purposely creating terrorism for many years. terrorism is a weapon that Washington intends to use to destabilize Russia and China by exporting it to the Muslim populations in Russia and China. Washington is using Syria as it used Ukraine to demonstrate Russia's impotence to Europe and to China, as an impotent Russia is less attractive to China as an ally. For Russia, responsible response to provocation has become a liability because it encourages more provocation. In other words, Washington and the gullibility of its European vassals have put humanity in a very dangerous situation, as the only choices left to Russia and China are to accept American vassalage or to prepare for war. Putin must be respected for putting more value on human life than do Washington and its European vassals, and avoiding military responses to provocations. However, Russia must do something to make the NATO countries aware that there are serious costs of their accommodation of Washington's aggression against Russia. For example, the Russian government could decide that it makes no sense to sell energy to European countries that are in a de facto state of war against Russia. With winter upon us, the Russian government could announce that Russia does not sell energy to NATO member countries. Russia would lose the money, but that is cheaper than losing one's sovereignty or a war. To end the conflict in Ukraine, or to escalate it to a level beyond Europe's willingness to participate, Russia could accept the requests of the breakaway provinces to be reunited with Russia. For Kiev to continue the conflict, Ukraine would have to attack Russia itself. The Russian government has relied on responsible, non-provocative responses. Russia has taken the diplomatic approach, relying on European governments coming to their senses, realizing that their national interests diverge from Washington's, and ceasing to enable Washington's hegemonic policy. Russia's policy has failed. To repeat, Russia's low-key, responsible responses have been used by Washington to paint Russia as a paper tiger that no one needs to fear. We are left with the paradox that Russia's determination to avoid war is leading directly to war. Whether or not the Russian media, Russian people, and the entirety of the Russian government understand this, it must be obvious to the Russian military. All that Russian military leaders need to do is to look at the composition of the forces sent by NATO to so-called combat ISIS. As George Ebert notes, the American, French, and British aircraft that have been deployed are jet fighters whose purpose is air-to-air combat, not ground attack. The jet fighters are not deployed to attack ISIS on the ground, but to threaten the Russian fighter bombers that are attacking ISIS ground targets. There is no doubt that Washington is driving the world towards Armageddon, and European is the enabler. Washington's bought and paid for puppets in Germany, France, and the UK are either stupid, unconcerned, or powerless to escape from Washington's grip. Russia has shown that it cannot wake Europe up. War, ladies and gentlemen, is therefore inevitable. We are on a collision course as certain as that between Germany and the Allies in the months leading up to World War II. And yes, you heard it here first. Well, many people are cheering now that Marine Le Pen and her Front National party didn't get to take over the government in any regions in the France regional elections. they should think again. The Front National did get a lot more votes than the last time around, and, though she will be a little disappointed after last weekend's results, it's exactly as Le Pen herself said, nothing can stop us. And instead of bemoaning this or even not believing it, it might be much better to try and understand why she's right. That has little to do with any comparisons to Donald Trump. Or perhaps it does, in that in the same way that Trump profits from people's perception of the systemic failures of Washington, Le Pen is being helped into the saddle by Brussels. The only remaining politicians in Europe who are critical of the EU are on the extreme right wing. The entire spectrum of politics, other than them, don't even question Brussels anymore. Which is at least a little strange, because support for the European Union on the street is not nearly as strong as among politicians, as referendum after referendum keeps on showing. Some of which have rejected the European Union, or at least more power to the EU outright, like the one in Denmark last week, while others do it indirectly by voting for anti-EU parties, like France this and last weekend. There's a long list of these votes going back through the years, with, for instance, both France and Holland saying no to the EU constitution in 2005, which led many countries to postpone their own votes on the topic. Brussels had an answer, though. By 2007, the constitution proposal was converted into a Treaty of Lisbon, which said basically the same, but in a different order and only through amendments to existing treaties. It was still rejected again in an Irish referendum, but in a second vote in 2009, accepted. Importantly, the switch from constitution to treaty meant unanimity among EU nations was no longer needed. A majority was good enough. So the whole thing was pushed through regardless of what people thought and voted. The overall picture is clear. Europeans in general are fine with the EU, but when it tries to grab more sovereign powers, they say no, time and time again, only to be overruled by their own domestic politicians as well as Brussels. Their worries, frictions and arguments have only one way to go, the far right. All other political currents are united in unwavering support for the EU, basically no matter what. But people see what's happening in Greece, and with refugees, they see the way the Union treats the Russia and Ukraine issues. They see the new-fangled unholy plans with the EU border force, and they don't want Brussels to tread on their respective nations' sovereignty any more than it already has. They find no resonance for their worries at home, however, other than with people like Le Pen, Nigel Farage and similar political outcasts. And therefore, that's where they will turn. All Le Pen has to do is wait for the economy to get worse, and it will, and she can reap what the EU has sown. As soon as Brussels threatens to turn into an authoritarian body, something it has already very evidently done, people will resist it. The European Union could have been a very useful and appreciated organisation with many obvious advantages for the people of Europe. But as soon as it oversteps its boundaries, it is destined to self-implode. This process and outcome has become inevitable because the Union has de facto appointed itself the arbiter of these boundaries. The unelected High Lords of Brussels have become too greedy and too unaccountable, and they will end up achieving the exact opposite of what they claim the EU stands for. They will lead the continent into conflict, armed and otherwise. The new border force concept is the perfect example of what's going wrong in Europe. A group of the largest and therefore most powerful EU nations have agreed on a rainy Monday afternoon that they're going to set up some sort of military police force that will so-called protect the borders of member nations, even if these nations don't ask for such protection and or outright resist it. This is obviously directed mostly at Greece for now, and the EU thinks it can do with Greece as it pleases. But ask any German, French or British citizen if they want entrance to their countries controlled and decided by a paramilitary bunch of foreigners, and they'll think you've lost it. But that's the idea behind the border force. Take away nations' sovereignty. Start with the smaller and weaker and work your way up. This has some interesting legal implications that few seem to even contemplate, and it will add to the entertainment. There are 28 separate constitutions in the EU. Under which of these is it legal for a government to sign away control of its own borders? In how many of these countries will this be appealed at their own version of the Supreme Court? And how many of these courts will say, sure, sovereignty is way overrated anyway? The EU could have been a useful union. Not all those border checks for one thing, not all those forms to fill out all the time. But with the advent of the euro, things got out of hand. You can have a functioning union between very different entities, but only as long as those differences are recognised and respected. The euro is an idea that seeks to deny the differences between the peoples of Europe. It seeks to claim that Germany, for example, is Greece. To that end, it must then take away all nations' sovereignty. The euro cannot exist without that. To function properly as a currency, it needs a banking union and a fiscal union, and then take it from there. These are all things that nobody properly thought or talked about before it was introduced. Perhaps because everyone knew that these things would be unacceptable to the European people, no? And now the euro's here and all these things will have to be pushed through anyway. Brussels thinks it has plenty of experience pushing things through, despite the will of the people. So this one will work too. But all it takes is for someone to point this out in clear language to people. Unfortunately, the only ones who do today connect this with resistance to refugees, to open societies, to all sorts of things that have nothing to do with why the Europe currency is a failure. Meanwhile, as I've said many times already, the EU is a body that self-selects for sociopaths in its hierarchy, being its undemocratic self. What few people recognise is that it also self-elects for the likes of Marine Le Pen. And we haven't seen anything yet. As I said before, all Le Pen has to do is for the economy to pine for the fjords. And look at the current commodities slaughter. That might happen before anyone can look it up in a dictionary. Angela Merkel pushed aside the Dublin Accord on refugees and opened German doors, and now she wants to close them again, as if that works. The EU now wants to hand Greece tens of millions of euros just to keep refugees in the country. But what happens when the recent projection of another 3 million arriving in Europe in 2016 comes to fruition? What happens when the refugees don't listen to the Berlin-Brussels dictates? One can only imagine the chaos. The EU has offered Turkey 3 billion euros plus to keep them there, but President Erdogan doesn't look like the kind of guy you can make a deal with and expect him to live up to it. Europe seriously risks being flooded with people while its economy shrinks like a cotton jersey in an autumn rainstorm. And who's going to be looking at the wannabe dictators in Brussels for help then? Nations will end up deciding to decide for themselves. And because all politicians but the far right have unequivocally supported the Union for many years, guess who'll be coming to dinner? Today, the victims are the Greeks and the refugees, and all whose governments cut their benefits to balance their budgets. Tomorrow, those budgets must be balanced all over Europe. In this line of thinking, as we witness the commodities plunge and the stock market crash, that must of necessity follow it. It becomes hard to see how countries like Italy, Spain, and even France could escape, resembling Greece a whole lot more in 2016. And then Europe will be right back where it left off 70 years ago. Well, thousands of years ago, in ancient city of Babylon, specially trained societies gathered each day in the temple of Marduk to record the day's events. They used cuneiform writing instruments and clay tablets, over 1,200 of which still survive today. These scribes kept excellent records, detailing astronomical observances and water levels of the Euphrates River, as well as market prices for the most popular commodities like wheat, barley, and wool. It's incredible that we have detailed records of grain prices going back thousands of years. The ancient Babylonians quoted grain prices in shekels, a unit of weight equivalent to 8.33 grams of silver. Over the 3-plus century period between 384 BC and 60 BC, for example, the price of barley averaged 0.02053 shekels per quart in Babylonia. At 8.33 grams per shekel, this would be equivalent to about 0.171 grams of silver per quart, or about $3.75 based on today's silver price. After converting the unit of measurement from ancient quart to modern hundredweight, that means that barley in Babylonian times sold for $5.23 per hundredweight when priced in today's dollars. And according to the US Department of Agriculture, yesterday's price for barley was $5.25 per hundredweight. Isn't that amazing, ladies and gentlemen? When denominated in silver, the price of barley is almost exactly the same as it was thousands of years ago. In other words, if a farmer from 23 centuries ago had sold a quart of barley, he would have received 0.171 grams of silver. Fast forward to today, and that 0.171 grams of silver would buy almost exactly the same amount of grain as it did 23 centuries ago. And yet those demented morons at the Federal Reserve think they can dictate prices tomorrow because they raised the short-term interest rate by a quarter of a point today. How laughable it would be if so many people's lives didn't depend on the whims of these retards today. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all I can give you. I'm done. I've had enough. You know, it's weekend for you, weekend for me. I'll be back on Monday with more. Please, tell your friends, let's get this act on the road. You have to listen. You have to wake up. And you have to take measures and deal with this situation. Because if you don't, you will be the losers. And that's pretty sad after years and years of years of listening to the wake-up call. And so with that, this is Richard Martin wishing you all a wonderful weekend. I will be back with you on Monday. Until then, bye-bye.
And there you have it. You decide.